listening to a podcast from DCT Audio. I'm Dave Thomas, and I've been producing audio content for over 10 years. Thank you for listening to this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. Well, I'm delighted to say that this morning we'll be joined by Detective Chief Inspector Lee Wilson of Lancashire Constabulary. Lee, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, David.
Perhaps just for the listeners, if you could just give us a brief summary of your career to date, I suppose.
Well into my final year now in policing, so 30 is looming large on the horizon. Worryingly, it's getting a lot closer, so that's June. 30 years in the police, majority of it at Blackpool and West, so Blackpool and Lancaster. Done a fair bit in uniform, but got on CID early, and that was something I always wanted to do. Worked every department, I think, across the CID portfolio, certainly in division, but done the plainclothes bit, done the reactive CID bit, which, if I'm honest, is my first love. I really enjoy that kind of work. Done the source handling, intelligence unit. That was good. Good times on there. Some good friends still from those times. And then after a fair period of time, actually, started thinking about the promotion process. A few years at Sergeant, learning a few bits and pieces around, dare I say it without sounding big-headed, what good maybe looked like, but also learning what not so good looked like, and have worked for good and bad over the years. Generally, far more of the good than the bad. And then, you know, DI on Intel, got promoted, actually, had a brief soiree back in uniform at Blackpool South as a sergeant. That actually did me well in terms of just a little bit of a, hang on, take stock, it's tough out here in wearing the blue suits.
Just give you a bit of perspective.
A bit of humility back, really, and a bit of understanding. So that was good. They used to do that back in the day, but now I think people, they sort of nail the colours to a path, don't they? And I'm going to be a detective. And we've got the direct entrance now, haven't we? Mm. And you push down that pipe, I suppose. But it didn't do me any harm. I can't say what it would be like for the organisation, but it did me no harm to step across a couple of times, which I did at Chief Inspector when I was promoted to Chief Inspector. Andy Rhodes decided that I needed a bit of time out of CID and uniform would do me good. So thanks very much for that, Mr. Rhodes. I know he's a friend to this programme. I hope he'll laugh when he hears that, if he ever hears it.
He's got a good sense of humour.
Yeah, he has that. And did a couple of years back in uniform at Blackpool, Chief Inspector, which I thoroughly enjoyed. There was still the tug at the heartstrings to get back to CID, but I never saw myself as a public order commander running around with all the gear on.
Did your friends.
No, indeed. Down the 583 at the fracking site. Yeah, running football matches as a bronze commander and doing that bronze command course. You know what? That was fabulous. And then got back to CID, took that back to CID and took a lot of learning from that. And I like to think I've got a bit of understanding and I probably know as many people in uniform as I do in CID these days. And I made some good links across the county, actually, because you're not just confined to where you routinely work when you're doing that. So that was really good. And seeing a little bit, there is life beyond Blackpool and the big city, Jack, and the Windy City and all the rest of it. And that, again, does you well. It's a good thing. But Lancashire's a big place. Mm. There are some cracking stuff. Some of the people I've worked with over the years, just they amaze me. What they can find, what they can deliver, what they can do for you, what they do for you. And an awful lot of it is unseen. It's quite humbling, actually. And to stand at the front of a briefing room, they're bringing you this information and they're helping you create a case and build a case. It's just like, wow, sometimes. And I think back to days of yore, but, you know, when I won't mention specific cases, but when some of the big cases that still live in the memory to this day and sat at the back of that briefing room as a young DC, maybe because it was a fairly young DC at some point, and thinking like, imagining that I could ever be at the front of that room, hosting the briefing as the officer in the case, the SIO, effectively, just never occurred to me.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because people go for promotion for all sorts of reasons. Mm. What was the reasons that you kind of pinned your flag to?
Gosh, that's a great question. I think there was definitely some motivation was like, well, I'm not being told how they get promoted. Not having that. No, and you need to sort yourself out here. Mrs. Wilson was always great at feedback as well. So, stop messing about and get your exam done. Family, I suppose. You do start to mature, don't you, as well? And you do start to have some ideas. And actually, It's very easy to sit being a synchronised arm folder with all the answers tutting when the boss, the sergeant, the whoever is trying to get the team to change, develop, yeah, alter in some way.
I suppose it's like, well, if you think you can do it better, why don't you?
Exactly that. That's exactly where I was sort of taking that one, mate. Have a go yourself. You know, it's all very well sitting on the margins, throwing the rocks and the bricks and the clever one-liners in. But, well, all right, then, I'm going to give it a go. Challenge accepted. And why not? And
well, it's interesting you say, you know, you stood at the front of the room, you know, you've got a major investigation, 50, 60 detectives perhaps, mm-hmm, and all the backroom staff, mm-hmm, the analysts, the homes, scenes of crime. Mm-hmm. I know Andy Rhodes talked about this when he was custody sergeant, this imposter syndrome. I wonder if you ever suffered that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, felt that. Yeah, felt that a number of times. But you just got to take a breath. You know what you're doing. The really tricky ones are, we haven't got a clue who's done this. How are we going to prove this? How on earth? Because you know there's a grieving family there. Mm. You know there's pressure from within the organisation. There's natural pressure. There's pressure on you professionally because somebody's trusted you to put you in the charge of that incident, in charge of that incident room. What are you going to do about it? And everybody is looking at you.
Yes.
What are we going to do about it, bud?
Well, that very nicely brings us on to an investigation that you led quite recently, and it had all those elements that you've just described. So for people that aren't aware, it was a homicide investigation. Just give us a bit of context and backdrop to that, first of all.
Well, on the 8th of February 24, a day that I think I will take with me till my last breath, it's just never going to leave me, that date. I was actually up in Scotland with Joe. We were away for the weekend, and we got wind as we were travelling up to Scotland that there'd been a shooting on a gym car park in Skelmersdale. A gentleman who'd been a prison officer had been shot and was likely to pass away. We kept my eye on that over the weekend. I knew that my colleagues, my peer group, if you will, within the major incident team were very busy and very stretched. I knew exactly who had it at that point in time. And I thought, that's going to be coming my way if this poor man doesn't pull through. So got back to the office on Monday. And you talk about that imposter syndrome. Phew, that is going to be a testing investigation. That is, and as I said, I sort of hinted out there, I just had 4 months off work. I needed that 4 months off work. But I did need, for my own purposes, that last 2 years, I did need to sort of test myself, really. Because I thought, I don't want to finish just disappearing quietly into the night. I want to come back and I want to finish my 30 years.
Yeah.
It means something to me. So, hey, I just treated it as an opportunity. I took a breath. Take your own advice. Take a breath. Step forward with confidence. Treat it as your opportunity in Oxford moment. Yeah, of course I'll go down to Skelmersdale. Huge incident room. Loads of staff I'd never met before. From different parts of the county.
So, well, as you said, those high-profile cases, was there a suspect in the frame at that point?
There were people emerging, but there was no fixed subject. You know, an obvious line of inquiry at that stage was the gentleman, Lenny Scott, his service in the prison service. Could that hold some clues? And as we know, subsequently, it absolutely did. But it was very early stages, massive amount of information coming in, as there always is. So much to do. You know, people are running on adrenaline. And then it's into that briefing room, and you prioritise things. You're doing a lot of mental arithmetic. You're doing a lot of dancing on the head of a pin. The information's coming at you thick and fast. You've got to get up to speed. You've got to sift what's important and what's not important. And early stages, everything's important because you've got to investigate it.
Yes.
You've got a finite number of staff, even though you've got a lot of staff, and the force through the kitchen sink at it quite properly. Needed it. You've got interest from chief officers. You've got chief officers turning up in your incident room.
So there's a pressure from the top as well.
Pressure from the top because, you know, who has done this? Could somebody else be harmed? There's a firearm out there. You know, shots fired on the streets is not good.
No.
By that time, you know, Lenny had succumbed to his injuries, unfortunately. You've got to see that family. You've got to have that. You've got to establish with that family that I will leave no stone unturned. They are grieving. They're actually heartbroken. The worst thing that they could possibly have dreamt has just happened to them. And you've got to somehow get through that, gain the trust, be honest with them, make them. I always make families a promise, I'll be honest with you. And if at this point all I can say to you is I can't tell you anything, then at this stage about that, but there will come a time when I can tell you. You've just got to bear with me, and that's that trust building. And it's really hard, and it's really intense. You know, you've got people who are literally dissolving in front of you, trying to be strong. It's harrowing, actually.
Mm.
But you put your game face on, and you step forward, again, with that confidence. And I always start my briefings with the family, updates around the family. I've worked with some brilliant family liaison officers over the time.
Well, they're crucial, aren't they?
Well, what a job that is. What a job that is. And, you know, the two leads I had on this, although there were extra flows brought in at different times to cover leave and so on, and the magnitude of the trial, which was 10 weeks in duration, brilliant. And Kelly was a lead flow on it. Sue was number two, both from section, you know, plucked from section. So they've still got a day job. They're not dedicated to the investigation. So challenging, so grateful. And they create that bridgehead between you as the SAO and the inquiry and the family.
Yeah, FLO work's difficult because you always leave a bit of yourself. It's that Locard's principle, isn't it? You know, every contact leaves a trace. Going back to the homicide investigation that you were asked to lead, what were some of the initial problems and blockers that you experienced?
I had two DIs on that investigation, and boy, did I need it. They were fabulous, Pete and Darren. I spoke to Pete, and Pete often used to reference back to standing in the first briefing on the first day, because he was on it from day one and stayed with it till the bitter end. How on earth are we going to detect this? This is going to be challenging. So there was that. There was the fact that as the inquiry started to develop and where Lenny had lived and where Lenny had worked and operated, because you want to study, you want to know as much about your victim as possible, because how they lived is perhaps going to tell you how they died and why they died. That's kind of a maxim that I've always lived by in my career. So we're in Liverpool. We're across the border. It's another police force. You'll know yourself, perhaps with the work you're doing now. Police forces don't always make easy bedfellows. They're very jealous about their information, with good reason. You tell a secret, then it's no longer a secret, is it? So there has to be all that. You've got that to overcome. Then is the prison service looking like it might hold again some clues for us? Yes, it is very much looking like that. And agencies, organisations, they can be quite defensive, the wrong word, but they want to know if they've made any mistakes. So those barriers start to come up. You've got to almost be a member of the UN in terms of your powers of persuasion. Again, though, it's about building trust. You've got to be honest with people. You've got to tell people where you're up to. But it's all done, you know, at an appropriate level within the organisations. And I have to say, the successful outcome of the investigation would not have happened without the brilliant and sterling cooperation of Merseyside Police and the prison service, you know, His Majesty's Prison and Probation Services. They are a phenomenal group of people working really, really hard in an incredibly challenging environment. Hats off to him. And I know, in particular, Paula, Lenny's mum, one legacy that she would like from her son's wicked death and the fact that he's no longer here with us is that if, you know, prison officers can be kept safer and perhaps senior people in the prison service and above that, dare I say, can sort of learn and know Lenny's story and why what happened to him happened, can be prevented, then she would be very happy for that to happen.
Was there a breakthrough moment in the investigation?
There was a really good moment. This plan was meticulously developed. It's an assassination, really, and it wasn't motivated by politics. It wasn't a state actor, was it? But I can only liken it to a planned and meticulous assassination, escape, clear up, accessing a firearm, you know. But the big thing for me was there's two vehicles here that seem to be linked to a group or an individual who are being spoken about and we are hearing about as potentially being involved in this. And I wanted those vehicles. Where are they? Where are they now? And get hands on them. I know from previous experience we can do some real damage in terms of taking us towards charging people, locking people and charging people, and ultimately end game, a successful outcome at court. White van was used as to preload the the hit, if we want to call it that, the murder, and put an e-bike and equipment down into Skelmersdale. And it was put in there the previous day, and it just sat there waiting for the gunman to arrive. And then another vehicle that he used on his own that day, that evening, because he'd done his homework and he knew exactly the point that Lenny was going to come out the gym where he trained, a jiu-jitsu gym. And that was where he was going to attack him. Got right down on the e-bike. No doubt, to my mind, we never prove this, but to my mind, he had the gun with him as he came out of Liverpool to go and do it. So these two vehicles, right. So we've never seen the white van. Got it on CCTV leaving to Skelmersdale. Some other like indicators that we know where it went.
Quite a few white vans on the road.
Quite a few white vans. So where it is to this day is a mystery. Never reported stolen, and there we are. But the other vehicle, which was a Mercedes, we did some work in the background, a bit obviously being careful what I say, but we did some work in the background and something had been done to that vehicle to stop it being tracked. We knew that much. But then, am I allowed to call people boffins? They were able to say, there's an alternative here. Do you want us to try it? Yeah. Get everybody on the ground in Liverpool. We might get some news. We might get lucky. And there was an element of luck because it might not work. Anyway, it did. A location. Everybody get there, block the ruddy street. I thought about sitting on it. Let's see if... But no, too much risk. What if somebody turns up with a firearm? You know, you've got all this running through your mind. Can't have officers hurt. How on earth would you, you know, if somebody got in that car with a key and they were off, what are you going to do? It's disappeared. You've already said it's like potentially evidential goldmine for you. I'm not going to let that drive away. So we know where it is. We're going to box it in. Nobody's going to enter it. Nobody's going to, you know, you're thinking all the forensics. Yeah. There's so much to think about. Yeah. But, you know, if that is a golden nugget, you've got to keep it as pristine as possible.
And you've hit something there. You're managing the evidential side of the investigation with the risk.
All of that. You're spinning plates like mad, and you're thinking all the time, which actually, some of that was the learning from the Public Order Command. And, you know, I talked around skills and bringing skills back in, and that is part of it. And you're gaming things through really quickly as well with trusted people around you. So I mentioned Pete and Darren, Tom Halliwell, who was a digital sergeant on it, Lauren Hickson, people like that. You're pulling on that experience because you're daft if you don't. You'll make a mistake if you don't. So got the vehicle. You asked if there was a like eureka moment. That was definitely a eureka moment. That was brilliant. I knew we were in business when I got that vehicle back. And boy, oh boy, had he tried to make sure we wouldn't get that vehicle back. The number plates has emerged in the coming weeks. Yeah. What it did give us is basically the roadmap for the job. It completely changed what we were doing in the investigative parameters, be that a day parameter, an area parameter, a combination of the two. We'd been looking in a certain area of Skelmersdale. You know, we'd been trying to walk through the likely escape routes, the way that the killer had come in, and that just blew it all wide open. And it was like, wow, we can see everything here now, pretty much. There were some limitations on it, but it completely, right, stop what you're doing over there. Everybody get here. Because the other thing you've got is a collapsing time frame.
Yes.
CCTV gets overwritten. You know, I think the preserved wisdom is you've got about a month. That's not the case with every system. But you've got to work against that. You can't go back in 32 days if it's going to be overwritten in 30 days. You've got to grab it. You've got to use as many pairs of hands because somebody's got to go out and do that grabbing. Somebody's got to knock on those doors. That was, I think, the key eureka moment.
Obviously, as a result of the investigation, suspects were arrested.
They were. We locked a lot of people up.
And that's another important milestone in the investigation, it is, isn't it?
It is. One thing I haven't done very often in my time on the major crime area is put people I suspect of murder out on bail. But I had to here because I didn't have enough when I first arrested him. That, you don't sleep. You're worried that they're going to flee.
Well, they know that you know.
They know that you know. Are they going to ride it out? As happened here, yes. I think they're sufficiently arrogant to think that they could ride it out and we wouldn't get anywhere. Are they going to flee and get to a country where there's no extradition treaty and you'll never see him again? So justice delayed is justice denied for that family, isn't it? Are they going to commit further offences? Are they going to intimidate people? Are they a threat to you going out and doing your job? Or more importantly, actually, me sending my staff out and other police officers to do their job on my behalf, and one of them runs up against a violent man who we suspect might have killed already. That's a concern and hamstrings the inquiry. Lots of sleepless nights, lots of long hours, because it becomes a professional challenge. All the while, you've got to keep an open mind as an investigator. You know, you can't get one-eyed and just, right, well, that individual's done it and we're going all in on that individual, because, you know, with disclosure and the way that that operates quite properly to ensure a fair trial, you've got to look at every reasonable line of inquiry. The law says that as an SIO. Again, if the public only knew, you know, the responsibilities that are placed on you. And if you don't, woe betide you, because you're going to end up potentially in that courtroom in 6 months' time, 12 months' time, whatever, with some people with enormous brains who have made a living and spend their entire career marking your homework and police officers' homework. And if you ain't got it right, it's going to be exposed, and they're going to do their very best for their client. It's adversarial. The system is very adversarial. You're going to be criticised to the high hills. And ultimately, probably more so than a lot of areas of the business we do, the book does start with you. You get it wrong. There's, you know, you've signed off on it. You've said that this is ready to go to trial, and, you know, the police investigation is complete, or as complete as you can make it. And if it's wrong, it's your fault.
So you said it after the suspect was bailed, it gave you some sleepless nights. I mean, how exactly did it impact on your mind, mental fitness?
Well, your brain is just jammed into overdrive. You know, that fight or flight. You're on that heightened awareness. You're thinking all the time about the case. It's very hard to put it down. I'm not saying this for everybody, but just me personally. I find it very hard to put it down. It consumes your thinking. You never really have a proper day off, because you're checking back in. How's that gone? You know, and I know I said I'd leave you alone to sort that out, but just how's it gone? Because you don't want any surprises as the SIO. You know, there's a bit of control freakery, but with good reason. Am I all over them, sort of scrutinising every decision that they make? No, trust them to go out and do the right thing. I trust them to put the foot on the ball, pick the phone up and say, we're thinking of doing this. Are you all right with that? Well, let's talk it through. You know, that gaming it out again, that's creating scenarios. But ultimately, they're out there. They need to fulfil a task. You've got to give them that answer, haven't you? Or trust your deputies to do it.
How did it affect family life?
Your family know you, don't they? Your family know you better than you know yourself, actually. They know the ups, they know the downs. I'd mentioned I'd had 4 months off, and, you know, that was burnout. I make no secret of that. Worked far too hard and then ran into a brick wall headlong, metaphorically speaking. I hasten to add, just ridiculous, actually, the situation I got into. Wasn't necessarily my fault. But I've got to take some ownership of it. You know, I should have put my hand up. And you can't work full throttle. Nobody can. Certainly not in the circumstances before. And I know there were probably a few people just around the margins, and a number of people spoke to me, and the wife spoke to me. A couple of the children spoke to me, and it was like, just be careful, Dad. Don't go there again.
Yeah.
But there's a difference, I think, between the type of work that got me to that situation in August 23 and being the SIO on a murder investigation. I actually find that gives me energy, despite the fact that you work in ridiculous hours, that you are jammed in that fight or flight. It's all the caveman brain. comes in. You want to do it right. You so badly want to bring the offenders to justice, to protect everybody widely, but more importantly, to be able to say to that family, we've done it.
It's the old saying, you can't get well in the environment that made you ill.
No.
And I'm just, were you conscious of, here we go again, I'm going to fall in the same traps?
No, never felt like I would. This might sound slightly strange, but I enjoy it like no other endeavour I've ever been involved in. We had some right down days and some difficult days and days where we're just not going to get it home. We're just not going to get there. He's been better than us. He's been smarter than us. He's outwitted us. Despite the fact that the evidence has come in, there's just, is there ever going to be enough? I never felt like it was, that was very different. And I'd taken, to get not well had probably taken me 18 months of hard work in the busy BCU work is very different to anything else in policing, really. You know, it's
more drip, isn't it?
It is, but yeah, there's a relentlessness to it. There's a thanklessness at times to it. There's a no matter what you do, it's not enough. You've got an awful lot of staff with an awful lot of issues that you're trying to do your best with all the while the work's coming in, day out, as you say, that relentlessness, that drip, drip, drip. There's a lot of scrutiny on it, a lot of measurement of it, a lot of performance measurement around what's going on, measuring productivity. There's a lot of scrutiny. It does leech away. And actually, there was too much work. You know, being blunt about it, there was too much work at that time, and it was too much. Yeah. It was just too much. I think then it was 27 years, and it took me 27 years to realise perhaps the job doesn't love me like I love it. People have likened it to me as you're a caretaker. We're here for your 30. You sign on for your 30, don't you? It's a young person's game because it does take so much out of you if you do it a certain way, policing. You do see all the worst bits of the Old Testament. And then all the pressure just trying to impress at work, trying to be right at work, trying to get everything right with staff who lack experience. In my own way, I've always tried to be fair. Even if you've had to address, you know, poor behaviour, somebody getting it wrong, and you have had to tick them off, and I have shouted at constables, you can move forward from it.
Going back to the homicide investigation... So we'll fast forward, and your suspect, which we can name him because he has
Alice Morgan, yeah.
Tell me about the day he was charged.
If we can just a couple of days before that, or probably a week before that, maybe, our barrister, Alex Leach, who unusually we got early, he came onto the case early because of the complexity. We had a CPS lawyer, Nicky Moore, who's absolutely fantastic, really good, but challenged us actually and pushed us, and you're not there yet, you're not yet there. And we quite vociferously agreed to disagree on occasion, and I thought there was enough and they should be arrested and they should be brought in. You're not there, you're not there. Well, you know, Nicky's looking at it from a lawyer's point of view 6 months down the line, and I am trying to do that, but I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a trial lawyer. I'm not a vastly experienced operator in that arena. That's what she brings. So they brought Alex Leach Casey in early doors. I'd worked with him on a case before. Ironically, he was for the defence on that case. So I knew of him, and he pushed us and he challenged us. He agreed to come and see the evidence again after a particularly charged conference on Teams. You can't be being around a room, in a room, can you? And seeing them, feeling the evidence and looking them in the eye kind of thing. They thought they were coming, the pair of them, I think for a cup of tea and, maybe a, you know, a biscuit and a chat and a look at the evidence. They walked into it. I'd set up like a summit meeting. I had all my key individuals at the desk with computers.
Sounds like an ambush.
Oh, it was an ambush. It was complete and utter deliberate on my part. It was gamed out to the nth degree with Pete and Darren and others. We had the big screen up. We were going to play the CCTV that we had, show them the evidence, and we were going through it. I sat Alex next to me. Nicky sat on the other side of him. Right at the front, in front of this screen, we were bringing, you know, people were commenting, we were weaving it all together. And there was a moment where we'd had a breakthrough that very morning. And Alex looked at me, he put his hand over his mouth. I will never forget it. And I've said this to him, and he looked at me like, well, really? And it was like the Wallace and Gromit moment where Feathers McGaw, the penguin, pulls the rubber glove off his head. And Wallace like, oh, it's you. It was that. And he actually said those words, oh, my God, it's him. You talked about Eureka moments earlier. I thought, yes, it is.
Yes.
They considered the evidence as we had it at that point. They put it together. Absolutely. Yeah. We'll go for it. We'll, you've got the authority to charge, which obviously you need for people who don't know that, from the Crown Prosecution Service. And, we planned it. There were certain things that I absolutely wanted to happen when we arrested him because he was cunning. He was devious in a criminal way. He was brilliant with his management of phones and communication data to a standard that we in Lancashire hadn't really seen before. So I wanted a phone off him, basically, is what I'm trying to say in a really roundabout way, an active phone that he was using to help move our investigation on. So we locked him up, didn't get what we wanted, but we knew there was a phone out there somewhere. So again, I'm not going to go into the detail, but I worked, I think... It was around about 96, between 96 and 100 hours that week from the point we arrested him, because just needed to be there and make sure things were happening. We had people out on the ground all over the place, and we got another breakthrough. We managed to get through a door where his phone was. that was like, wow, that was a magic moment. Certainly the digital media team, Lauren and Tom and Co, were sort of dancing around and so excited. It's like a very early Christmas present for them, because they're slotting things together, aren't they, as they go along. And, you know, any piece of data they can get, any number they can get that they can hang the hat on, it can suddenly light things up and open up different avenues. It's incredibly complicated, the work that they do. But they challenged me, actually. Get us a phone back, boss. Right. Okay. It's not that easy, though, is it? No. He doesn't turn up with it in his pocket, and he's not going to. He's not going to make. He's already made a mistake, and he knew he'd made a mistake letting us get that Mercedes back. He must have known. I was losing sleep. He must have been losing sleep. I suppose it'd come between, like, who blinks first. Is he going to run to Dubai or somewhere? Or is he going to try and tough it out, in safe in the knowledge that he'd done enough and, yeah, the police won't get anything. I've cleaned that car. They'll not get anything out of it. You know, I had access to the right people who actually proved him wrong.
Do we know what his reaction was when he was charged?
Deadpan. He's career criminal. He knows the game inside and out. He actually described it from the witness box as a job, prison. Being arrested.
Occupational.
Yeah, exactly that. He said that's what you should have seen the jury's face. I'll never forget the jury's face when he said that. I always thought he could just do prison standing on his head, as we say. Yeah. It was, it holds no fears for him.
So how did the trial go then?
Well, it was a 10-week marathon at Preston Crown Court, Court 1, which is, I suppose, it's still a very modern building, but I think Court 1 there in the basement. It's iconic. You know, there's been some notable trials down there. Yeah, absolutely. So it basically, you know, don't you, from all the trials you've done over the years, there will come a point in time where it'll tip and the emphasis will, you know, if it's right and your evidence is right and your case is right, the emphasis will shift back to the Crown, but the defence will attack you all the way. It's adversarial.
And like you said, that is the time that all that work is now under the microscope.
You just don't know where they're going. And what they're ostensibly doing is they're testing. And they're looking for a point of weakness. They're looking for something that they can exploit. They call it proactive defence, I think, don't they? And very often, they're not particularly looking at the evidence. They're looking in your disclosure. They're looking at the way you've done disclosure. They're looking at the... And yet, at one point on this, to get through the sheer volume of material, and it was massive. I think we had every single one of the six FMIT disclosure officers deployed on the case just to get through, because otherwise we wouldn't have done it. It was that big. And I've never known that before. We had an additional barrister on the case purely to deal with the disclosure. And it was, as I say, for sort of 5-6 weeks, it was attacked, because that's what they are, searching, questioning. It was challenge. And a lot of that doesn't actually go on in the courtroom. You know, people see it on the TV, don't they? And you know, there's these grandiose speeches, eureka moments with evidence, you know, pulled out of brown evidence bags, and that's it. And the case falls apart, and an officer's found to be lying in their testimony. Yeah, that's all makes for good telly, because it's very theatrical. So much of it's going on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had a police room at the side, just through the double doors there, you'll know it. That was the nerve centre. But we had officers back at Preston Police Station. We had officers in other parts of the county we could draw on, in Merseyside, who were helping us, in the prison service who were helping us, and actually members of the prison service were alongside the court team and were invaluable to us. They were there every day. And it just keeps coming and just keeps coming. But you know, and there was a point, talked to a few people about it, that we were in the room. It was a morning. I can't remember the specific day, but probably week 4, week 5. Darren was stood with a laptop open in each hand, just trying to manage what urgent inquiry am I doing this morning. Pete was, I think, raging down the phone at somebody. Something else had gone wrong with something, or he couldn't get hold of an officer or something that he absolutely needed and we needed at court that day. Mr. Leach was in the corner. He came in as he did, sat down, taking his wig off, and said, right, today's mini crisis that we have to avert here, ladies and gentlemen, is... So I'm like, right, Anna Willits, I think, was in the room, probably one of the DCs, and they were really involved in something that wasn't quite panning out as we'd seen. And I was literally sat in the corner drinking a brew. And I just thought, God, I'm going to miss this.
Really?
Yeah. I just looked round and I just had this like overwhelming sense of fondness. And it's a drug.
Sounds like you're in the Colosseum.
It is a little bit like that. Yeah, I'm probably overdoing it, over-egging it a little bit and a bit of hyperbole there, but it just... I love trials. I love the cut and thrust of it. The focus and everything. You asked me before, you know, family, what were family thinking, Lee, when you're like not sleeping for those? It's kind of like, right, trial, forget dad. We're doing this weekend. is Dad going to come? No, he'll be absolutely jiggered after busy week. Just let him go down with it. We're having loads of conversations, Joe and I. It's like, well, just get the trial out of the way. Just get the trial out of the way. Just get the trial out of the way. It consumes you.
And the danger is, with all that evidence that you've got, and that I've done jury serving myself, you've got to be careful you don't lose the jury. It's that finding that balance, isn't it, to not batter the jury.
This is why those top-level advocates, they're just phenomenal people, aren't they? Tell the story. They talk about telling stories and your narrative for the case. But you've got to tell that story. You're absolutely right, so that the jury understand it. And that's not being condescending to juries. You know, they've got their pluck from everyday life, aren't they?
Yes.
That's the strength of that system. Mm. With hopefully no preconceived ideas, no particular hang-ups, and they swear an oath, don't they? You'll try the case according to the evidence.
Yeah.
And nothing else, and nothing on social media. And, you know, they're warned about that constantly by the judges. It's a huge responsibility. I got the sense that the jury were listening intently, and you know, don't get me wrong, the trial was so stop start.
So was there a point in the trial process then the jury is sent out and you're going, I really don't know which way this is going to go? What was your sense of feeling when the jury was sent out in this case?
I honestly thought we'd done enough, and I thought they would come back and convict Morgan. I just couldn't call it around the other defendant. I wasn't sure around him, and we'd prepared our discussions with the family were very much along the lines of worst case scenario. If we haven't convinced them, if we haven't done our job right and both are acquitted, then, you know, they've got to be ready for that eventuality.
Yeah.
I know from the conversations we were having that they thought that certainly Morgan would be convicted. They were quietly confident, but you just don't know, do you?
No, you don't.
And it's quite proper that you don't know.
Yes.
You present your case in the best way that you can. They came back after 5 hours and 20-odd minutes, I think it was. We had a break over lunch.
A verdict?
Yeah, we were notified. That's got a verdict. That's quick.
That is quick.
After a 10-week trial.
Yeah.
It was really good, albeit with some breaks in between. So it was like, right, okay, big breath. And you sat there, you could hear a pin drop. Tense can be, and the judge addressed the public gallery and said the verdicts will be delivered in silence. There will be no outbursts from the public gallery. You wouldn't anyway, because it wouldn't be professional, but I must confess, I just quietly and under the table, as it were,
I punched
the air. I won't lie. I punched the air. I was so relieved, pleased, proud. Actually, that's the overriding one. And
so obviously he was found guilty.
He was found guilty. Yes, he was. He was convicted unanimously by the 11 members of the jury. We'd lost the jury member. You know, that was another pressure. God, we're down to 11.
Does happen.
Yeah, it does.
Quite regularly, actually.
Fortunately, I was able to glance straight over at the family. Paula and Neil, Lenny's parents, were on the front row just off to my left. And
that's a safety valve, that moment.
Looked straight over him, and you could see the emotion. You could see, you know, for 18 months, and the trial was supposed to happen a lot sooner, but for a variety of reasons, it didn't. You know, they'd just stayed with us. They'd kept their faith. They'd kept the faith in the system. It was very emotional, very, very emotional, and a release. But, you know, heart of stone, you put your game face on. It's about the family's grief. And I'd said it to the team, you know, it's not for us to start melting. And, you know, it doesn't matter how emotional it gets, that can come later when we go for a well-earned drink in the pub.
Yeah.
We're here for the family, and we're steely-eyed murder squad detective. So
can you remember the first person you rang after the verdict came in? I'm guessing it would have been Joe, your wife, but maybe not.
I actually can't. Wow, that's a great... I think I got a lot of calls in, you know, because actually you've got your phone on silent. This will sound corny, but I suppose it's just me. All my thoughts were with that family, and there's a man been acquitted as well at that dock. What are we going to do with him? Is he now under threat? Is there a risk to him? So that all had to be worked through. But it was, you know, there were a lot of hugs. There was a lot of thank yous and a lot of, you know... That is an absolute killer question you've asked me there. I don't know. I did ring Joe really quick. I rang my dad, actually, as well.
Yeah, oh, bless you.
Because he was obviously ex-job and a big inspiration. Yeah. You know, another reason, perhaps going back to the start of this, why did you join? Well, I wanted to be like my dad.
I believe it was a significant sentence that was passed down.
45 years.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, yeah. We applied for whole life, but for reasons I think we all understood, actually, the judge said no, but what it does demand, and actually the public deserve, is a massive dare I say it, life ending, probably, prison sentence. Yeah. You know, it was 30-odd, 45 years. I wouldn't want to be sat in that cell that morning facing that. Goodness me, I can only imagine what was going through. I don't actually care, but I can only imagine what was going through his mind. My view of this is the case is and should be about Lenny and Lenny's family. Evil was done to him.
Mm.
And, you know, that word gets thrown around a lot, but he is evil. Probably as much as I want to say about him, really. It's good riddance.
The judge did give out several commendations, which in this day and age are quite rare, actually.
I suppose so, yeah. It's always nice. I've had a couple over the years, I think, but Mr. Justice Goose as well, very eminent High Court judge. They miss nothing, these
people.
They're unbelievable, aren't they? So that was a very nice moment and richly deserved. A lot of people did a hell of a lot of work on that. I'm the one who gets put in front of the cameras and people associate me with it, but it was a good moment for them. And I know they were all chuffed to bits. Two from the prison service also commended and one from Merseyside Police.
Well, I suppose finally, having led a homicide investigation of that magnitude, what, in terms of leadership, perhaps somebody that you've looked up to previously, that when you were a DC or whenever you were in your stage of career, what is something that they have told you that you've taken forward? And then what have you learnt that you can pass forward to the future leaders coming in?
A salutary moment for me was I was a DS working at the Old Child Protection Syndicate at the football ground. Do you remember?
I do,
co-located with. Yeah. Really good model, actually. Worked very well. And a fella called Pete Yates, I don't know if you remember Pete, he was a retired DS and he came back, ended up being the referral manager, used to work alongside Pete. And he said to me one day, Lee, can I just say, he was going to say it anyway, just stop being... You're trying to be some sort of television cop. Don't do that. You're a nice bloke. You're a nice lad. I think were the words he used. Be more of yourself, because that's the good stuff. And I took that away and I thought, wow. But I thought about that and I've thought about it many, many times since. And whilst there's still a bit of that in me, because I'm a natural born show off, and I know that, sometimes too much, but a lot less as I've got older and matured. That was a brilliant piece of advice that he gave me that day. And I've tried to lean into that a lot ever since.
So, going forward then,
yes.
What have you learnt that you would want to pass on to future leaders?
Give it a go. If you don't give it a go, you'll never know. Be prepared to test yourself. Understand the rules of engagement, I think, would be a big one for me. You won't go into a cup final, would you, that might go into extra time and you've not practised a few penalties. Be prepared for knockbacks. Don't take it personally if you do get those knockbacks. Treat them as a learning fork in the road type thing. And just remember that the only people who remember you work late are your children. And I think you said, didn't you, beforehand, the slight different take on that. But, you know, the testament that you weren't there is the fact that you're not on the family photographs.
Yes.
For the weddings and the, and you know. And
Christmas party.
You know, I've put in the job before family. You know, I missed my dad's 80th birthday. I didn't get there till like half 10 at night. They were going to bed. Because I was running a firearms discharge, ironically, up at Lancaster. And somebody had to do it. And there was nobody else. Well, I'd known he was going to be 80 for as long as I'd been on the planet on that day. And with a bit of planning. But, you know, there's only me can do this. Well, hang on, you're not Superman. Who's the dafty there, really? You know, you're caretaking this for 30 years, aren't you? And if you're fortunate enough to last the 30 and you can stay the course. And things happen to people and they just can't. And, you know, you've got to wish them well as they move on and thank them for the service that they have given.
Yes. How long have you got left now?
I could tell you if I could just glance at my phone, but I think it's about 7 months and 12 days.
Right.
About. I don't know the hours, but I could tell you that, Dave.
I mean, we all say the same thing, don't we, to our mates that you've made it.
I never wanted to be that person who was clock watching getting towards the end, but I kind of have become that. But I feel like I'm a bit in the way. Because, you know, there's others who quite naturally, it's natural progression, isn't it? They, you know, they want to come up and they want their shot.
Mm-hmm.
I've had my kind of thing. And I
don't think you are, Clot. I mean, I know you've got a job on at the moment, which we can't talk about. But, I mean, that's going to see you through very nicely to retirement.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yeah, it's presented its own problems. I'm sure it'll keep you very busy.
Yeah, have a few more grey hairs, yeah.
Lee Wilson, it's been an absolute delight to speak to you today. Thank you so much for your time.
And thank you, David. I've really enjoyed it.
DCT Audio. The art of good listening.